Choke points, brought to you by Online Trading Academy. I asked Chris to check out something that happened to me the other day. We've come back from the opera. It was about 10 o'clock. It was the Steve Jobs opera, short opera. And I was looking forward to making my escape from the Seattle Center area, which always there's always a traffic jam getting out of the opera, by taking the new Highway 99 tunnel. So I scoot out and go out, I think, on Roy Street and hit Highway 99, you know, at the stop sign there, and then just, you know, peel on down through the tunnel. I think I'm going to get right onto I-90, and I get off at the exit, and there is a cop there at the stadium saying, no, you will not turn left. And my eyes were saying, you know, why can I not turn left? But he was not having any of it, and so he sends me off into this road I'd never seen before, and off I go either to pick up a cargo to ship to Boston at the truck terminal, or I go to West Seattle, or I go back onto Alaskan Way. So, Chris, what gives? Why are they not letting people make a left turn there? Apparently, there was a Sounders game.
Yeah, and that's the key thing, is you ran into the post-game traffic control for the Sounders match, and this is the first time we've had a major sporting event or event at the stadiums since the tunnel has been in operation. And so I wanted to go find out, oh, okay, this is one of those things that maybe they hadn't thought about or hadn't been put into practice as of yet. And so what happened was you got off there at Dearborn to access I-90, go on to Edgar Martinez.
Right.
And as you know, after events there at the stadiums, that's where the parking garage is for Safeco, or people
that's
use
right.
for CenturyLink as well. And so they, by definition, they block any eastbound traffic from First Avenue because they have to empty that garage. That's just the way it works. And so in talking to the Department of Transportation and the Seattle Police, that is going to be that way. So the public needs to know that you will not have any access to I-90 from the southbound tunnel getting off at Dearborn and then getting onto Edgar Martinez anytime during those post-game letouts for Sounders, Seahawks, Mariners, or any big concerts at either one of those venues. So you're going to have to time your drive if you want to go to I-90 to miss those post-game events, or you're going to have to drive around. That's just the way the traffic...
Well, then what about, we've got this network of message signs. Why not at least put that on a message sign so that people know before they get into the tunnel? Because once upon a time, you could get off downtown. Now
Correct.
You cannot.
And I asked them, and the question is, well, if you put the message, no access to I-90 from Dearborn in the tunnel southbound, well, you're already in the tunnel at that point.
Well, then I know how to get off, though. I'll go down to the West Seattle Freeway and then loop back around.
Or do they put something further up by the Aurora Bridge? Well, then it might be confusing to people who aren't then going through the tunnel. So when I talk to the police and the Department of Transportation, their bottom line answer is, listen, we're figuring this out. Right now, we're trying to, the traffic patterns are changing. People are going different ways they may not have gone before or accessing ways, and we haven't quite figured that out yet. So they're looking at all of this traffic management during games, post games, and they're going to tweak where they can and go forward. This was the first attempt at it, and it didn't work. We got another Sounders match coming up this weekend. We've got 81 Mariners games
yeah.
coming up. But from what I hear from the police, it's going to stay no access to I-90 getting out of Dearborn, out of the tunnel, just because that's the way their traffic management plan seems to work for emptying the garage. But they're willing to look at it as they go forward. But yeah, that was a major, I think, shock to you and
yes,
to others who think they can use 99 and get right on to I-90 via Edgar Martinez.
And we still have a roundabout debate going on.
Oh, yes, we do. Our listener, Tanya Hughes, hit me up recently, and she wrote, quote, as more circular intersections pop up in Snohomish County, the public should be educated how to navigate through them. Please inform the public who has the right of way. So I said, okay, Tanya, what roundabout are you looking about specifically? Because they are going in all over the place. And she said the one just west of I-5 up near the Tulalip Reservation there in Marysville. And they are, in case you don't know, they're putting in a new casino there. They're expanding their operations there. And so they've added at least one roundabout. There's going to be at least one more. So I went up there and I watched.
Mm-hmm.
I watched for a while. And I was appalled by the lack of understanding of how a roundabout works.
What were they doing?
Well, first of all, I saw people just going right through the yield sign and going right into the roundabout blowing off rule number one of all roundabouts, which is you must yield to people already in the roundabout.
Right.
That one I kind of figured. I'm like, okay, some people may not understand exactly how that works or how much room they need to leave. But either way, that was number one. But then what I saw time after time, which shocked me, people in the roundabout would come to a complete stop and wave the person in as if it was a four-way stop.
To be polite?
I was there in 15 minutes. I'm not going to lie. There were at least three or four people who stopped, waved the person in. You never stop in a roundabout. I don't understand why people don't get it. But yeah, that's rule number two. Never stop in the roundabout. The other one is don't change lanes if it's a multiple lane one. You got to pick where you got to go on the front end. But yeah, so that's the bottom line is people still don't seem to understand how roundabouts work. It's pretty simple. Yield to those inside. Stay in your lane when you're. So if it's a two-lane one and you're in the right lane, don't all of a sudden cut into the middle so you realize, I needed to go around. No, you need to plan ahead a little bit.
You got to know where you're going. It's okay to go around more than once.
Completely. If you miss your turn, you can work your way around like Clark Griswold with Big Ben in Parliament in European Vacation. But you should never stop. I couldn't believe it. It's like, that just showed a basic misunderstanding. And I know roundabouts are not, we don't teach that very much. It's in the book. There isn't a lot of teaching about it. But this is a way that the Department of Transportation is looking. They're much cheaper than building intersections. They're much cheaper than building lighted signals with left turn pockets or left turn rights or right turn pockets. They're coming all over the place, and people have got to learn how to use them. So Tanya was worried. Our listener Tanya, she was worried I'm going to get hit or injured one. And I'm not surprised looking at that particular intersection. And it's not just that one. I've seen them at all. It's Snohomish County. You just got to follow those two rules. Yield to those inside. Never stop in a roundabout.
What you need to do is just everybody spend a weekend in London. Their roundabouts go the opposite way, but at least you'll understand the etiquette.
Yeah, and it's just, and the people just blowing through too, just that scares me too, is that people not understanding, you know, what's happening in there. Because I know it's a new thing, but it should be pretty simple. But I mean, the last time I did a roundabout 101 was only a couple of months ago, and yet people keep asking me to remind folks how it works because it's a safety issue.
Chris Sullivan, thanks for the advice, by the way.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I am generous with my horn at roundabouts. 623. That's probably illegal.
Yes, it is. Only in an emergency circumstance, but that's on you.
Emergency,
so yes.
If they want to stop in the middle of a roundabout, I might rear-end it.
Yeah, I agree. Go ahead.
There you go.
I'm not going to hit you up on the noise violation.
Hannah Scott is here with, I think, a very hopeful development in our state's backlog of rape kits. There are several thousand, and there have been some bills working their way through the legislature to get these backlogs unclogged, I guess you could say. So what happened last night, Hannah?
So there's a couple of different bills going on. The first one does address that rape kit backlog. It's an effort that's been going on for years, led by Democrat Tina Orwell over in the House. This year we had our biggest bill to date. This would fund a new lab that can cut the testing time down to about 45 days, from which is now more than a year that it takes, about 14 months on
average.
And
this is based on the Ohio lab that successfully cleared all of its backlogged.
Yeah, Ohio kits. And Oregon also, where they the Portland has cleared some of its backlog. But yes, Ohio, which had already cleared it, was a backlog bigger than ours. This does that. It also sets deadlines. It also, for the very first time, believe it or not, mandates that all of these old kits are actually sent for testing. That's something that hasn't happened until now.
And there's been success in actually finding an alleged rapist after testing some of these kits that date back to the 80s in our
82
state.
82 was the oldest test.
All they had to do was test it, and there's the DNA, there's the person, they cuff him.
Yeah, and that's the point that Representative Orwell made on the House floor last night.
We've tested about 1,800 kits since 2015, and we've already identified four serial rapists. One was of a girl in 2007 who was brutally raped for 2 days, and her kits sat on a shelf for 10 years. And there's just so many more survivors that are living in fear that we can help get them for justice, so we can fix this.
There was also a lot of frustration on the House floor, including from Representative Republican Michelle Calder, who's a sexual assault survivor herself.
You know, when I first joined the legislature 5 years ago, I was pretty surprised as to how many thousands of rape kits just sat there untested. And I thought, well, for sure, this would be a priority for our state. And yet here we are, 5 years later, and we still have not made testing rape kits a priority in our state by funding them. I'm embarrassed. Time's up. We need to make sexual assault survivors a priority.
And that was the mood all across the House floor. This passed unanimously off the House floor last night. It now moves on to the Senate. The big thing we need to address here, though, is that it comes with a $13 million budget ask. That will be worked out as we get into the later part of the session when budgets are handled. And there's a lot of other priorities, mental health and other.
Yeah, $13 million. So where's that money going to come from?
They're going to need to carve it out in the budget. So there's certainly going to be some noise made about that once we get it through the Senate and moved on into the budget process.
Do you think of all the issues because of Me Too, because of the successful testing of old rape kits and the arrest of suspects, that perhaps this actually will happen this time around?
I really do think that this will pass this time around for sure. And I think I have strong feelings that I think it will get the budget money that it's being asked for. That's going to be a fight, I'm sure. But look, there's a lot of attention on this particular issue, not just in our state, across the country, where mm-hmm. all kinds of states are dealing with their rape kit backlogs. And every single time you're hearing these same stories, when we test these kits, we're finding serial offenders who've been allowed to stay out on the streets and
10,
still attack
later.
Your kids, attack your wife, attack yeah. whomever, because nobody tested the kit. So
and
there's a lot of pressure.
Going back to the very start, you could go a few ways with what's the reason this was never prioritized? Is it resources, or is it because we do not prioritize the feelings and trauma of sexual assault victims?
Absolutely. I mean, and that's definitely something that you would hear has been an issue. And I think that that's the thing that they're trying to change now, which again, with the Me Too movement, is trying to change. Another big reason that across the country, here in our state too, that some of these kits have been left on shelves is that there was, you know, if it was an assault where you knew the offender, mm-hmm. cops would be like, prosecutors are like, we really aren't going to get a prosecution here. So we're not going to send it. It's not worth it. Or if they just simply didn't believe you, that was also part of the problem. So
it's nice to see some change.
I do want to point out really quickly, Dan Griffey's bill to extend the statute of limitations also went through last night. And that's moving on. That's another one that's a great bill that he's been fighting for several years that he believes will actually pass this year.
Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Joining us now, Windermere Chief Economist Matthew Gardner to take a look at long-term housing trends. To start with, there has been some concern on the part of homeowners that the housing market has gotten soft and the boom may be over. What's your assessment?
And that's certainly something which we've heard a lot about over the last several months. Essentially, what happened here is that pricing, let's say in King County, peaked last May. And from last May, really through the balance of the year, it's been trending downward. And that's actually something which a lot of people have been very concerned about. So, you know, are we on the cusp of another market crash? What I would say is you cannot look at individual months or even a number of months in isolation. If you look at the 6-month average or the 12-month average, price in King County are actually up by about 8%. So taking numbers in isolation, you kind of can become a kind of Chicken Little. Everyone's worried that the sky is falling in. Is that the case? No, it's not. We did reach a peak in the fall. We certainly have pulled back, but the long-term trend is still positive, and it will remain to be positive, I would argue, given the fact that our economy is still doing so remarkably well.
Is Chinese money a factor here? I was surprised to hear you talk about the amount of Chinese investment still going on in Seattle.
It's certainly less than we have seen, and it's less for several reasons. Twofold. Firstly, on the commercial side, we saw several very major purchases. I mean, Columbia Tower is a good example of it.
It's owned by China now?
Owned by, well, a Hong Kong-based entity, so essentially, yeah, that's the case. We'll see less of those. We have seen less of those, quite frankly, for one simple reason. The value of the dollar, the strength of the dollar has increased, which therefore makes it more expensive for foreigners to buy whatever asset they're looking to buy in the U.S. So dollar strength has hurt. On the residential side, we still see a very significant amount of interest. It's a bit less than we had seen over the course of the last couple of years. But there are still a lot of Asian families buying homes in Seattle. And a lot of it's actually kind of interesting why they're doing it. A lot of times it's for their children. Mm-hmm. And it's for their children to live in whilst they're at university over here. They come in, they buy the house. They don't like their children to be in dormitories. They like safety for them or the perception of it. they're buying houses, which you might think is just a nice thing for mom and dad to do. But there's an alternative reason as well.
Are the kids living in those homes unsupervised?
Yes, they are. And a lot of these homes are in Hunts Point, Medina, Yarrow Bay, hardly the cheapest markets in the Pacific Northwest. But the other reason why they're interested in owning homes here is that once their child graduates, they will then sell the house with the goal of, yes, we've made some money. So everyone's chasing yield. They want to make some money. Where can you? They're buying houses over here. Ultimately, however, are we the most popular market in the country? No, we're not. They tend to prefer California, Florida, and parts of the Northeast, actually around Vermont, which I find kind of interesting. But are they here? Yes, they are. They're just not as effusive. They're not buying as much as they were, again, because of the strength of the dollar has made everything more expensive.
What about the trade deal negotiations with China, which have been sort of going hot and cold? I don't know if they're hot or they're cold at this point, but there have been some nasty things said.
And there have. And that's an interesting thing, because President Xi Jinping a while ago said one thing. It's that no one wins a trade war. He's absolutely right about that. But what he has also said to the population there is, why are you investing in a country that dislikes us? So he's actually trying to make it harder to get currency out of mainland China to invest. And because
he may pour some cold water on the Chinese investment here?
We've already seen a slowing down. It wouldn't surprise me to see more of a slowing down in that respect. Yes, he's making it hard, but quite frankly, it's actually not that hard to get money out of China to bring it across the U.S. But he is looking the other way. He's saying, I want domestic investment. I don't want foreign investment. So invest your money here, not in a country which, quite frankly, doesn't like us. And therefore, that's because we're getting into these trade war issues. Hopefully, the trade wars will be settled or solved at some point, possibly in the near term. I hope that's the case. But do we know if it's going to happen or not? Quite frankly, we don't.
Building activity still seems to be pretty high in downtown Seattle.
Yes, it is. And it's still mainly commercial in terms of apartments. We are still overbuilding apartments.
I tell you, we were taking a stroll, would have been Sunday. And we walked into one of these pop-up exhibits of a new apartment building called First Light, which looks like basically an urban cruise ship with a swimming pool on the roof. I mean, and they've got plans for not just that, but several of these crazy-looking buildings.
The reason why they're looking crazy now, obviously it's a highly competitive market.
Yeah.
You've pretty much got to figure out what makes your widget better than the widget next door. And so they're putting in all these pools and all these additional amenities. However, at the same time, demand is finite. There's only so much of it out there. And quite frankly, it's still remarkably expensive to build apartments. And therefore, you've got to command some very, very high rents. The question is,
so what kind of rents are we talking about for these architect-designed and furnished apartments?
Not furnished, but in terms of architect-designed, you're looking north of $4 per square foot. What that means is a 1,000-square-foot unit, $4,000 a month in rent.
Whoa. That's pretty pricey. So you're saying so you don't think the market can sustain that, huh?
No, if you think about it, it was several years ago we broke $2 a square foot. Then probably 3 years ago we broke $3 a square foot, maybe a bit longer than that. So the rate of rental rate growth has far exceeded income growth. And then, again, there must always be a relationship, whether you look at apartments or ownership housing, between incomes and prices.
And then in contrast, you have some of the butt-ugly buildings that are being revealed by the demolition of the viaduct, including some graffiti walls I didn't know existed. How long till that's all cleaned up?
Oh, it's going to be a while. I mean, they seem to be progressing through very nicely right now, and you've got to kind of thank the weather gods in that respect. It's going to be an arduous, fairly, extensive demolition. It's going to be an amazing thing when it's done, I would argue. It's going to reveal a lot of real estate, as you mentioned, maybe not so much the graffitied walls, but you've got a lot of buildings which were adjacent to the viaduct. All of a sudden, their value is going to be skyrocketing.
Yeah. Well, are they going to stay or going to be demolished?
I would suggest a lot of them probably going to stay. If not, then the historic preservation guys are probably going to be all over trying to keep as many of them as they can, which is what they do.
That's right. Economist Matthew Gardner from Windermere Real Estate. Matthew, thank you.
You're welcome.
For your daily dose of kindness, one mistake took a homeless man from a shelter to success, and of course, he's giving back. It began when Stefan DeArmond returned home to South Carolina to care for his parents. But he had nothing. He just knew it was his duty to care for them. So he swallowed his pride and contacted the VA to find out if they could help him with housing. But there was nothing. However, they could put him in a shelter, and he accepted.
Being homeless is a different animal. It's not pleasant. You can't sleep with one eye open. So being homeless, you don't get the rest that your body needs for you to be able to be successful or even productive.
He spoke with NBC, and he said through the shelter, he joined a culinary training program. It turned out to be his calling. He was a natural, and eventually he and his fellow culinary students were sent to a food and wine festival, and their mission was to find a job. Stefan excelled.
The band kicked on, and Stefan lit up. I started swaying and clapping, and he had his black chef coat and his white undershirt. And I said, "Sir, you've got the spirit. I'm calling you the Reverend, and you're coming to work at Smoke Barbecue."
That's Ronald Feldman, who is now Stefan's business partner. And here's where we get to that mistake. Stefan was tasked with making the cornbread one day, and he mixed up the buttermilk for heavy cream. But they went ahead and cooked it anyway, just to see what would happen.
Lo and behold, it came out a little bit higher. It came out more moist. It was golden brown. And he was like, "Wow." We passed the food out so everybody can check it out and say, "Well, or not, we're going to serve it." And everyone loved it. That gave Roland the idea of he and I going into business. And now we have the Reverend Cornbread Company.
That company is a wild success. So Stefan decided to open a food truck, too, and having been homeless at one point, decided that several times a month he would drive that food truck around and feed the homeless.
Sometimes mistakes can turn into the best thing, especially when cooking.
A full circle story of success and kindness. It's time for our Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers. And it's Danny O'Neill, who is down at spring training in Peoria, Arizona this week. I don't know why I have a hard time saying that, Danny. Peoria.
Well, there's a lot of vowels that are mixed up in there.
I know. How is it down there, Sunny?
It's great. Yeah, it was gorgeous yesterday. We got a little cloud cover this morning, but it's been absolutely fantastic. I hear there might have been a little more snow yesterday.
Yeah, just a little, though. So
that's
I want to get to this.
Just a dusting.
Yeah, just a dusting. Maybe some slushy dusting. This story about Dee Gordon, this is what I live for. This is why I have my daily dose of kindness every morning at 7:30, because people love good news. And Dee made all of us feel good with how he treated a fan yesterday at spring training.
It was a fan, and I think it was probably a little more personal to us because it was the sister of Curtis Rogers, who he hosts Seattle Sports at Night. He works on our show. He's someone who is 27 years old and one of the most knowledgeable sports fans I've ever come across. He's from Kent, and his sister, Anne, was there. And Anne is 36 years old. She has Down syndrome, and as Curtis said, she's the second biggest sports fan he knows next to him and the biggest Mariners fan. And as Dee Gordon was coming back from batting practice yesterday, he saw Ann, and he stopped, and he started with his batting gloves, which he gave to her, and then he proceeded to give her the compression arm sleeve that he wears and put that on her right arm, just like Dee wears it on his right arm, and then gave her his bat, which was exceptionally cool. And you could see, first of all, just her light up, and the second thing was is, this is something we're not out with the fans. This was kind of a behind the scenes moment of his eyes just caught her as he came by, and he came over, and it was just this really, really touching moment where he had this really powerful interaction. It was really, really cool to see.
What is it? I mean, a lot of these guys on the teams, they're nice guys and they do great things for their fans. But what does this say about Dee specifically and what we know about him?
I think it shows you the level of engagement here. Here's what I always think is that I don't begrudge a player who's very, very focused on his job and tries to sort of channel himself and focus himself and get rid of distractions. But there's always, when you see a guy who has an awareness of the people around him, and this was one of those things of like, Dee saw an opportunity to sort of give of himself and give of his time and a recognition of the impact that that's going to have on somebody. And I think that that's what I saw, is that this wasn't going through autograph line, or it was a spur of the moment, sort of he felt a connection or felt drawn or for whatever reason saw an opportunity here to have a really, really positive interaction with someone. And I think pro athletes, by and large, are incredibly generous with their time. And I've always said something like autographs, those aren't a bottomless pit, because mm-hmm. no matter how long you stay inside, there's usually going to be somebody at the end that you can't accommodate who's going to feel like, oh, I didn't get that. And I think they are, by and large, really, really generous with their time. And I think that there are people that are extraordinary. And what I saw was how present Dee was in that moment. That's and how much of an impact that connection he made had.
And Curtis's sister, too, she's a Special Olympics athlete. She's got a lot of medals, competes in swimming every year. So
she's a great swimmer.
Athlete
yes.
to athlete, they really did make a connection. We had earlier on the show, Heather Bosch, our afternoon anchor, she did a piece on all the new Mariners commercials out there, and it's so nostalgic. I look forward to it every year. Of course, Light Bat is probably my favorite one with Edgar Martinez. Do any other teams do stuff like this? Is this unique to the Mariners?
I think everybody has commercials. Every team has commercials. What's unique about the Mariners is how good theirs are mm-hmm. and how they've become. There are things that every marketing team, and it is marketing. It's finding a way. But every marketing team tries to connect with their fan base in the way that the Mariners have succeeded in doing that. And I don't want to begrudge that or say, like, oh, it's just advertising, because it's part of an understanding of what their fan base likes about their players and ways to be. I think they're incredibly creative, and I think that they give. We just talked about Dee Gordon making a connection with one fan. I think players like the opportunity to show a lighter-hearted side of themselves, and there's a certain amount of trust of, like, hey, this is something our fans enjoy, and seeing the crafty left-handers. I think my favorite is Dee Gordon's, where he gets the pit stop at third base and the NASCAR crew comes out to change the tires and do all the rotations. Like, I thought that was really cool. But it's a success in terms of creating something that people look forward to seeing. And I think that's really, really cool. They're extremely creative. And I guess as someone who I like to think of myself as, I try to be creative and try to find ways to engage with people. Mm-hmm. The Mariners marketing team has been exceptional with that.
Yeah. The commercials are, I mean, for me, it's more than just the game. I need that personal connection with the players. So I'm sure glad the Mariners stand out in that. All right, Denny, thank you. Enjoy the sunny weather. When are you coming back?
You bet. I'm going to be back on Monday, so I'll see you guys later that afternoon.
Bring the sunshine with you, will you?
I hope I do.
All right. Thanks, Danny. For those of you that don't recognize the song, it's out of Auburn University.
I hate that fight song.
I know. Sorry.
I really do.
The year is 2010. Cam Newton leads his team to victory over Alabama in the Iron Bowl. Coming back from a 24-0 deficit, it would lead one Alabama fan to commit a gross act of herbicide. And for that, we're joined by CBS's Mo Rocca. Good morning, Mo.
Good morning, Colleen and Chris. How are you all doing?
We're good. Well, Sully's a little disturbed by the fight song. He's from Notre Dame, so.
Yeah, and Auburn beat Oregon in the national championship game this same year that Mo's you're talking about.
Well, I hope this story doesn't trigger you then and give you PTSD or something. But
nah.
This story just, I have to tell you, disturbed me when I first read about it.
Well, I was reading sort of your synopsis of, and this is from your podcast, Mobituaries, and this sounds like a truly disturbed person.
Right. This is about a man named Harvey Updike, who, as you pointed out, was so upset after Alabama lost in the Iron Bowl. That's every year, Thanksgiving Day weekend, Auburn, University of Alabama and Auburn, both in the state of Alabama. They are arch enemies. They meet in this game, which is, excuse me, arguably more important than the national championship, and really divides the state. Cam Newton came back, big victory called the Cam Back, and Harvey Updike went to Auburn's campus and poisoned two beloved oak trees, over 80 years old. These oak trees were really a symbol of the campus of Auburn. And when I read about it, I found it more than disturbing. I found it sinister. And I know it's not the killing of an animal and obviously not the killing of a human being, but the killing of these trees, I found sinister.
Those trees were 80 years old. I have a deep respect for nature. And so to think that those trees could stand for 80 years and one very disturbed sports fan decides to pour 500 times the lethal amount of herbicide onto them. I think it rises to the level of some type of form of plant cruelty.
Well, right, and he went to prison for 6 months and was on probation for 5 years and ordered to pay over $800,000 in restitution. But I should tell you that in this episode of the podcast, I go and I spend time with Harvey Updike post-probation, his probation, not mine. And I have to tell you, I found him sort of maddening because on the one hand, he did this horrible thing. On the other hand, he's a doting grandfather. He's engaging, and at the risk of infuriating anyone who is an Auburn partisan out there, I found him kind of likable.
He's a grant. So, okay, why did I imagine this was a college student?
No. When I met him last summer, he was 69. I think he may be 70 now. And this happened, I'm doing the math right now very quickly, this happened back in 2011. So, right, he was about 61 years old when he did this, 60 or 61. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting, is, at least in the state of Alabama, is there are fans of both teams, Alabama, University of Alabama and Auburn, who are kind of disparagingly known as the pickup truck alumni. These are people that didn't go to the schools, but they are more rabid in their fandom than the actual alums. And so it's there's something kind of obviously very sad and kind of poignant about it as well, that he went and did this thing thinking that he would come home the conquering hero to the University of Alabama, and no less a person than Alabama head coach Nick Saban denounced him, and understandably, because he went to the campus and killed these beloved trees.
Mo, this is I'm a huge college football fan, have been all my life, and I know there are people who to this is more important than life, and you got a few beers in them and you can go and do ridiculous things. Does he ever explain, you know, I mean, it sounds like he planned this. There was so much premeditation. This wasn't some fit of, oh, I'm going to get them. This was so planned out. This is beyond most things that I've even seen that are awful, you know, that happened in the moment.
Well, you know, one moment I would find him engaging and actually, quite frankly, funny. He's not an idiot. And then he did something more than idiotic, but he's not a dumb person. And so at moments I'd find him engaging, and the next moment I felt like I was sitting across from someone who'd been radicalized, as he described in cold, calculating terms how he planned the killing of the trees. You know, covering this story, I think, puts me next in line to become the chief CBS Mideast correspondent because, you know, college football, I mean, in a way, I'm sort of an outsider. My brother is a longtime baseball beat writer and columnist, so I kind of know it by osmosis. I understand it by osmosis, but I'm not so involved. So for me, it was sort of interesting. I felt like I was going to a foreign culture, you know, covering this. But you're right. It's like religious warfare. And there's such long history here. And they're almost like religious figures, almost like saints or like Bear Bryant looms, right? I mean, this is a person who's been dead since 1983, the legendary Alabama coach. It was on behalf of him that Harvey Updike, that's the name of the tree killer, that Harvey killed the trees because he felt like he was defending the honor of Bear Bryant.
Oh my God, I'm a little bit on your side, Mo, when it comes to trying to understand allegiance to something like a college or a mascot or a university. The closest I could get to it, though, is when the Seahawks in the Super Bowl threw the ball instead of giving it to Marshawn Lynch, and I actually lost sleep and I went, oh, I get it now. You get really close and very personal with some sports teams when you watch them succeed and then watch them fall. So when you sat with him, did you get the feeling that 6 months in jail and 5 years probation was enough?
I struggled with it because even when I first read about this incident, I was horrified, and then I thought, is there something wrong with me? Because if I hear about the killing of a person, you know, somewhere far away, am I going to be this upset by this? And am I just some sort of, you know, Northeast urbanite that, you know, that sheds a tear over the death of a tree? And do I have my priorities straight? Sorry, what was your question? So when I was sitting
was
across
it enough?
From him,
yeah.
Say that again, sorry?
Was the punishment enough?
Oh, was the punishment enough? Right. So I struggle with it because I know that he knows, and he tells me this, that what he did was wrong. I think the real question, and I'm curious what listeners think, is, does he truly regret it? Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, the key question. And frankly, would he do it again? And I can't answer that, but we do speak at length, so you'll be able to hear him and judge for yourself. I'm also interested, maybe Chris will weigh in on this, is that line between fan and fanatic. And, you know, you see on social media fans going nuts, right, when their team loses. You know, do a lot of fans have this in them? Is it only...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Go to the Oregon-Washington football game at either opposite stadium in the other colors, and you will find it out in a hurry. So, yeah, it's nasty out there at college football around the country with some of these rivalries.
Right. And so there are the seed, if you will, of a potential tree killer is in a lot of people, I guess, a lot of angry fans.
Creepy, Mo. This story can be found in Mobituaries. It's released tomorrow, correct?
That's correct. Available wherever you get your podcast.
Delightful. Thanks for joining us again, Mo.
Thank you both. Great talking to you.
You too.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Seattle has been on a crusade to try and keep plastic out of the oceans. So we tried banning plastic bags. We're moving on now to plastic straws. Wouldn't it be easier if trash would just disappear before it had to be banned? And now Trader Joe's is taking that approach. And Rachel Bell, are you as enthusiastic about this as I am?
Ooh, I am so excited about this. Trader Joe's actually uses a lot of plastic. So if you just go to a classic grocery store, chances are you're going to see all of the produce, you know, out, and then you can choose to put it in a plastic bag or not. But for those of us who go to Trader Joe's, you know that most of their vegetables come on these little styrofoam trays and they're wrapped in shrink wrap. And a lot of people I know have been complaining about this, saying they're not going to shop there anymore. So Trader Joe's is listening to its customers, and their goal this year, or they say it's going to happen, they are eliminating more than 1 million pounds of plastic from their store this year. So here are some of the examples. And this one is the one that actually I notice at home. The little packets that the tea bag comes in is not recyclable. And it always bugs me that I can't recycle that little packet. So they are actually eliminating non-recyclable plastic and foil pouches that come in their tea bags. They're eliminating the plastic bags that come around when you get a bouquet of flowers, that kind of plastic wrap.
Right.
They're getting rid of the plastic sleeves on their greeting cards, and they're going to replace them with compostable material. All of the styrofoam trays are going to be gone from the meat and the fish. They're going to replace that as well. And then they're going to try and do more loose produce. So their apples and pears and potato bags are going to go away. And it looks like there's maybe a few more things, but that's a lot of
Reduction. The plastic, there's a picture here of the, what is this, okra? I don't know what it is. Oh, cucumbers, the Persian cucumbers, which come in these plastic.
Those are my favorite.
What I notice is, because there's sometimes I just don't want to cook. So I'll go to the deli and get the prepackaged, I love the green pea salads that they do, little bacon bits in them.
Uh-huh.
But you end up with, like, after dinner, four or five of these plastic containers.
Yeah.
It would be nice if they would, after a certain period of time, just decompose themselves.
Yeah, I mean, we've chosen convenience in our lives, and that has meant a lot more packaging, you know, with Amazon getting delivered things to your home and, you know, going and getting a bag of salad where every single component has a plastic wrapping.
Yes.
And down to, you know, a lot of people using these meal kits, you know, Blue Apron and things like that. And so it's interesting because I think the same people who are using these convenience items are also people who are environmental, and it's, you kind of get on the scale like, well, what's better for my life, convenience or garbage? So I'm so glad that Trader Joe's is doing this, because one of the things I read in the article was, you know, in China, we've been hearing they're not recycling all of our stuff.
That's
anymore.
Right.
So we
it's
kind
all too
of
dirty.
It's too dirty. And so a lot of regions have just stopped the recycling program. So we have to stop recycling, and we have to start reducing. You know, don't make the material in the first place that you have to recycle. Just use
right.
compostable items.
Packaging is supposed to be temporary anyway. If you're leaving your food around for 4 months, especially if it's produce, the package should deteriorate.
Exactly.
So I think I don't think this is something that's beyond our scientific knowledge to be able to create a package which, after a while, just decomposes. So even if some idiot were to throw it into the ocean, it wouldn't be there for long. And, I would actually change my shopping habits to a store that did that, because I'm sick of throwing all this stuff away.
There's a place in West Seattle I just discovered. I haven't made it out there yet. It's called a Public Shop, and you can bring in your own containers and fill up with dish soap, laundry detergent, shampoo, conditioner, which is the next step, it seems, in my circle for eliminating all the plastic in your bathroom, because all of your cosmetics come in plastic. And unlike at the grocery store where, you know, you can bring a canvas bag and not use the plastic bags for your produce, how are you going to get your shampoo? It has to come in something.
That's right.
And so I tried recently, I went to my supermarket, a town and country market, to refill an olive oil bottle, because I thought, you know, even though you can recycle it, I'm going to try to refill. And it was so expensive. It was more than double the price that I paid. I bought the original olive oil at Trader Joe's. Yeah. And then I went to a nicer market, which are the only places where they allow you to refill. And yeah, it was more than double. And I thought, well, this is for the elite to be able to be environmental.
That's exactly
right. So there needs to be something, you know, that works in favor of everyone, because if you're eliminating the bottle, why should the product be more expensive? So I'm going to try this a Public Shop in West Seattle, and I'm crossing my fingers that it's not going to be crazy expensive, but I have to check it out first.
Let us know how it goes.
I will.
Rachel Earth.
I love that. Was the greatest verbal typo I've ever heard.
I know, but I was trying to say that Rachel is doing her best to try to save the Earth. We're running out of time, so I just edited out all the intervening words.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. Rachel Mother Earth will do from now on. Thank you.